the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah
the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Civilian deaths, multiple injuries as Israel launches an air raid against the central Syrian province. Saudi military bombing Yemen again, killing two civilians in Sana'a province. The UN nuclear chief says all countries should join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Press TV's exclusive interview with Rafael Grossi, coming up. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Israel's aerial aggression against Syria, taking more lives. Syrian media are reporting two civilian deaths in the latest airstrikes targeting a central province. In the early morning hours, several people have also been injured. Syrian air defenses intercepted the attack above the western city of Homs. Israel frequently strikes targets within Syria. Last week, it launched a missile strike against the capital, Damascus. Syrian government accuses Tel Aviv of supporting terrorist groups that are operating on its soil. The UK's decision to outlaw Palestinian resistance movement Hamas continues to draw condemnations by Palestinian factions in a conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Palestinian factions voiced their support for the resistance fronts. Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more in this report.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip titled Resistance is a Legitimate Right to Condemn the UK's Plan to Ban Hamas Movement. Hundreds of people attended the conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. On Friday, the UK's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, laid before the British Parliament an order to outlaw the Hamas resistance movement in its entirety. Patel made the order while giving a keynote speech at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. The proscription makes it a criminal offense in the United Kingdom to be a member of or invite support for Hamas, with those found guilty facing up to 14 years in prison.
The British decision to include Hamas on its terror list is biased and violates the rights of Palestinian people. With this decision, the UK has entrenched itself with the enemies of the Palestinian people. This decision has no value to Palestinians and will continue the resistance until driving out the occupiers from the land of Palestine.
The close relationship between the United Kingdom and the Israeli regime has been one of the most salient features in British foreign policy for decades.
Palestinian resistance factions are holding this national conference to assert their refusal to these British policies. The British Home Secretary is violating the international law by listing Hamas movement as a terror group. This biased British policy gives the Zionist enemy the green light to commit more war crimes against the Palestinian people.
All Palestinian factions have expressed shock and dismay and accused the UK of continuing with its aggression against the Palestinian people. Palestinians accuse the UK of committing a historic sin against them in the infamous Balfour Declaration and the British mandate that handed Palestine to the Israeli occupation.
It is our right to resist the Zionist occupation of Palestine. The UK's decision is a dangerous infringement on the right of the Palestinian people to resist the occupation and confront the aggression that our people have been subjected to for decades. Neither Britain nor anyone else can stop all forms of Palestinian resistance.
People in the blockaded coastal territory have always accused the United Kingdom of aiding and abetting the Israeli regime in its crimes against the Palestinian people.
Palestinians, like other oppressed peoples, have the right to resist occupation. Experts say that any attempt to accuse Palestinian resistance groups of terrorism is a violation of international law. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
American technology company Apple files a lawsuit against an already notorious Israeli spyware maker. The iPhone maker says the NSO group has used its Pegasus spyware to hack the devices of Apple users. The American tech giant says the Israeli firm manipulated its servers to deliver the attacks using more than 100 fake Apple IDs. The U.S. firm is now seeking a court order to permanently ban NSO from using Apple servers and devices. This is the latest in a series of legal actions against NSO. Just weeks ago, the U.S. blacklisted the spyware maker for what it called enabling transitional repression. Facebook also sued NSO 2 years ago, accusing it of cyber espionage on journalists and human rights activists. NSO denies all that. It says its software is designed for use by authorities in fighting terrorism and other crimes. Mr. Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joins us via Skype out of San Francisco. Mr. Bennett, it's good to have you with us. Please help us understand this story a bit better.
Well, it's very simple and it's very complicated. The simple explanation is this is an Israeli Mossad intelligence cyber warfare company that the U.S. FBI, Central Intelligence Agency, know full well what they're doing. And they have the full green light acceptance and encouragement by the U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies to do things that the U.S. government agencies cannot do. So the government is very, very enthusiastic and desiring of these Israeli intelligence firms to hack and penetrate and overcome any form of telecommunication security or any computer technological firm that may have security barriers. The U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies are only too ecstatic and excited to reward Israel for doing things that they know the U.S. agencies cannot, as many former high-level officers in the United States Air Force, such as Keith Alexander and others who were in charge of the National Security Agency, have said these U.S. agencies have been caught spying on their own people. But they do even worse through the employment of mercenary groups like the Israeli firm NSO. So what Apple really is doing, it's a unique company, Apple, which produces some of the best computers and the best telephones that are on the market, and they are essentially impenetrable. So the Israelis, with the full blessing of the United States FBI and Central Intelligence Agency and Department of Justice and the Defense Intelligence Network, these Israeli firms go after and have tried to penetrate Apple, and Apple has stood up and filed lawsuit. Now, the U.S. intelligence agencies and law enforcement have a long history of doing this sort of thing to other companies and individuals, and it really becomes a Dostoevsky sort of tale of just how sinister and corrupt the U.S. government and law enforcement is, because For example, there was a company called Quest Communications back in 2007, and Joe Nocio, who I knew from my former life, Joe Nocio was president and CEO of Quest Communications, and the U.S. government wanted access to all of the U.S. customers and foreign seas customers that Quest Communications had in its database. And Joe Nocio stood up and said he would not surrender the details and the personal information of his clients, of his Quest Communication members. As a result of him standing up against that unconstitutional act of tyranny by the U.S. government, Joe Nocio was thrown in jail, was imprisoned by the U.S. government, and his company was forced to surrender information on its own clients. So the U.S. does this routinely. They seek information on American citizens through companies like Quest Communications. They engineer and orchestrate Israeli Mossad mercenary operations to do the dirty work. And they also go after individual citizens and basically try and overcome all barriers and defensive capabilities of private companies to protect the personal information of citizens. So it's something to recognize that NSO is a Mossad Israeli operation. It's doing its operations with the full gratitude of the U.S. intelligence, CIA, Department of Justice. They have a long history of doing this. They also have other programs such as the DEF program, DEAF, which is another government intelligence defensive technology that they sell a lot of these programs, convincing Americans that their data will be protected, when in actuality they're being sold off and they're being constructed into databases. So this is part of a big behavioral model, mapping out people's locations, mapping out their buying habits, mapping out where they go, when they go, what they say, to whom they say it, a full social control agenda by a U.S. deep state. And the technology firms of Israel are the Trojan horses, because Israel can do these things that the U.S. government cannot, and then they can elude any sort of repercussions or criminal actions because they're in another country. Mm-hmm. But make no mistake, the United States government, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the FBI, the Department of Justice have a full green light and reward for the Israeli Pegasus systems, which I know Julian Assange and many other military people came to the understanding that Pegasus was a spying operation. Mm-hmm. That once again the Israelis are constantly exercising to listen in to everyone that they possibly can. The Americans, United Nations officials, media persons, politicians. Obama was also guilty of utilizing much of this technology in spying through the NSA European leaders. So mm-hmm. this is why, in one regard, the U.S. Cyber and telecommunications industry cannot be trusted for confidentiality, and nor can the American government.
Many, many thanks, Mr. Scott Bennett in San Francisco. Have a good time, sir. Saudi Arabia's military aggression against neighboring Yemen continues. Yemeni media are reporting a Saudi coalition warplanes bombed two districts in the capital, Sana'a, hours ago. The air raids left two civilians dead and two others injured. Riyadh also carried out aerial and artillery strikes on several Yemeni provinces on Tuesday, leaving multiple civilian casualties. Saudi regime claimed to have bombed a ballistic missile launch site in Sana'a, but Yemeni sources said it had actually targeted residential areas. Riyadh and its allies launched a war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions more displaced in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Yemeni patients' struggle for life is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war, especially for those with chronic diseases such as kidney failure. Yemen's health officials warned that over thousands of kidney patients may die if they do not go abroad for treatment. Correspondent in Yemen's capital reports.
The Saudi led war on Yemen has devastated the country's healthcare system so that individuals with chronic diseases can't have access to life-saving treatment. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the number of kidney patients has exceeded 4,850. Most of them may die if they don't get the chance to travel abroad for a kidney transplant.
We receive patients from across Yemen. We face frequent power cuts due to the fuel crisis. That's why most patients die, because they don't receive full treatment.
The number of dialysis centers in Yemen is not enough to meet the needs. Saleh says he waits for hours for dialysis sessions for his wife.
We come from a faraway region, and that's why most of the time we are late here. We call on the international organizations to open new dialysis centers to alleviate the suffering of these patients.
Most of the centers has to reduce the number of dialysis sessions for each patient to cope with the large number of patients. The fuel crisis in Yemen is also piling up pressure on hospitals, forcing many dialysis centers to close down.
We suffer from power cuts. Unfortunately, the number of dialysis sessions has been reduced to only 2 sessions per week due to the siege and increasing number of patients. I'm not from this city, so I have to rent a house in Sana'a, and this is an extra burden.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has also led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, who needed to travel abroad for treatment unavailable in Yemen, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade. The Saudi-led war in Yemen is taking a heavy toll on the health sector, limiting patients' access to critical care, especially those with chronic diseases. The shortage of medical supplies, fuel, and funds has forced many hospitals to close down, putting at risk the lives of thousands of patients, including children. Avratif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Press TV has conducted an exclusive interview with the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency during his visit to Iran. Rafael Grossi described the mood as positive, saying he's had excellent meetings with Iranian officials.
Where do you see this? You've had the meetings today, and of course in a few days the meetings will be taking place again.
Yes.
Your overall perspective and what you...
My perspective is a positive one. I believe that we have to work in a way, Iran and the agency, and I had excellent meetings with the foreign minister just now, with other authorities, with the president of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, so that we can move in the clarification of certain outstanding issues that we have, and hopefully when the and if the JCPOA is restored, as I said before, to help the community of the JCPOA to bring this agreement into the fruition it was supposed to be created to.
Grossi was also asked about the agency's stance on Israeli acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program and its assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. He said the IAEA condemns any act of violence, although it does not conduct investigations or allocate responsibilities. He said peaceful uses of nuclear technology are the inalienable right of every state. However, the IAEA chief stressed that all countries should join the non-proliferation treaty designed to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Grossi said he would like to see a world free of nuclear weapons, but added the IAEA has a non-proliferation mandate and not a disarmament one. The Russian defense minister says U.S. bombers have practiced using nuclear weapons close to his country's borders. According to Sergei Shoigu, the U.S. has carried out over 30 flights as close as 20 kilometers from the Russian border over the past month. That's 2.5 times more than the number of missions flown over the same period last year. And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life. And made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
A new Mint Press news study based on Department of Defense documents can reveal that U.S. weapons manufacturers have sold well in excess of $28.3 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began, including 20 separate deals inked during Biden's presidency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Despite Pledge, Biden Leaves Tap Open, Approving Billions in Arms Deals to Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. The war in Yemen must end, declared President Joe Biden in his first major foreign policy speech. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive Saudi operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales, unquote. Yet, studying sales records from the U.S. Department of Defense, DOD, Ben Press can reveal that less than 1 year into his presidency, the Biden administration has already approved 20 separate weapons contracts worth just shy of $1.2 billion to Saudi Arabia alone. This includes a $100 million shipment of Black Hawk helicopters, support for Apache gunships, and a $78 million deal to buy 36 cruise missiles. A new and controversial $650 million deal announced earlier this month has yet to be finalized, but will likely soon follow, boosting sales up to levels equal with the earlier years of the Trump presidency. The Saudi-led coalition is once again pummeling Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Images appear to show U.S.-made aircraft attacking ground targets. This is hardly surprising. American arms sales to Saudi Arabia have long been a point of contention. But this Mint Press investigation will reveal the extent to which private American companies are profiting off the infliction of suffering on the Yemeni people. Sorting through thousands of approved contracts, the Department of Defense has approved in excess of $28.4 billion worth of sales from American companies to the armed forces of Saudi Arabia since they began their military intervention in the Yemeni war in March 2015. This includes billions of dollars worth of arms, supplies, logistical support, and training services. While this is a gargantuan number, already larger than Yemen's gross domestic product, it is certainly a serious underestimate of just how much the military-industrial complex is benefiting from what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In addition to the $28 billion figure, Saudi Arabia is also a named customer, often along with other nations, in weapons deals worth more than $34 billion over the same period. However, the amounts the Saudis actually paid in these were not disclosed, though in some of these orders, Saudi Arabia was clearly the primary buyer. For example, a $3.4 billion DOD-approved radar deal with Raytheon lists only two buyers, Saudi Arabia and the tiny nation of Kuwait with a population of 4.2 million. Together, this means that the DOD has green-lighted the sale of somewhere between $28 billion and $63 billion worth of arms from American companies to Saudi Arabia since the latter began its attack on the largely civilian population of Yemen. Of course, the U.S. was supplying the Saudis well before the war started and also continues to sell billions of dollars worth of weapons to other partners in the Saudi war on Yemen, such as Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE. Therefore, this number only begins to tell the story of corporate American war profiteering. Selling weapons of war to such a repressive government was already ethically questionable. By March 2015, there was no way one could credibly argue that arms sales to Saudi Arabia would be used in a purely defensive manner. Nevertheless, they continue to grow, fueling the violence. From March to December 2015, sales to Saudi Arabia totaled $1.56 billion. But under Trump, that number ballooned to $5.47 billion in 2019 and $14.36 billion in 2020. Facing increased opposition even inside Washington, Trump even used his presidential veto to unblock an $8.1 billion deal. Although the Biden administration has not overseen the bonanza fire sale its predecessors oversaw, the flow of arms has not stopped. President Biden said, "We are going to see an end to U.S. complicity in the Saudi war and blockade on Yemen." Unfortunately, this new $650 million weapon sales perpetuates both the war and the blockade that's pushing millions of Yemenis into famine, said Hassan Al-Tayeb, legislative director for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a pro-peace lobbying group associated with the Quaker movement, adding, "These air-to-air munitions, combined with other forms of military aid, send a message of impunity to the Saudis as they continue their destructive behavior in Yemen, with no consequences from key allies like the United States. Now is not the time to be green-lighting new arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Now is the time to use existing U.S. leverage to end the Saudi blockade before more Yemenis are plunged into famine."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Child poverty in Britain. Part 2.
There are very large numbers of people that question the war in Afghanistan, question the war in Iraq, and question the intervention in Libya, saying, really what those wars are about, demonstrating military power, but also the vast mineral reserves and wealth that's there in Afghanistan to be exploited, the oil reserves that are there in Iraq to be exploited, and the oil reserves that are there in Libya to be exploited. We're in a global race for resources, and the global race means there's winners and losers. If you win, you control, but you have, there's a price at control, and that price is armed occupation. Surely, we need a much more rational approach to the world. We need to defend and protect our environment for all of us. We need to end the wars and start redistributing wealth rather than grabbing from each other.
Since the onset of the crisis in 2008, I think the cost of the war has become an additional issue, which angers people. I think they think, if you're going to reduce my wages and cut my welfare services, what the hell do you think you're doing, fighting wars which in any case I thought were wrong? And I think that's a very, very widely held view. The Trade Union Congress, representing 7 million workers, passed a resolution this year saying that the Afghan war should end, and that the Iraq war was wrong, that the Libya intervention was wrong. And that, in addition to the opinion poll evidence, shows that many working people just don't accept the argument for the war, just don't accept the cost of it.
We're being told we're all in this together. Well, we're not all in this together. We're all being told to tighten our belts and be careful about our spending, and yet the government wants us to be supporting businesses. Well, we would support businesses if we didn't have to support the war. The government's always got money for war. It's always got money for warmongering. Why do we interfere in places like Libya? I think the money being spent on war should be put back into our economy. There's plenty of money. There's no need for any of these cuts. Believe you me, I am absolutely certain if the people who should be paying their taxes were paying their taxes, instead of, you know, big businesses, which is what I'm talking about, going off and putting their money in offshore accounts where they're not paying into the UK economy, if we weren't supporting the arms trade, and make no bones about it, I would imagine there's absolutely loads of ministers and people in the cabinet and the government who are paying, who are getting money back, rather, from profits from the arms trade and from war. Why do they give money for warmongering? Why do they support this? Well, they're also cutting the defence budget, I have to say, because they will profit from it, because it suits them. It suits Britain to be in a strategic military position around the world where there's oil, where there's mineral wealth, where there's things that we want.
Same time as British, many people in Britain and elsewhere are suffering very, very badly from the economic crisis. Their lives are getting worse. A time when we're being told that we have to accept cuts to our welfare provision, to the NHS, to social services, to childcare, to all these things. We're also being told that it is essential that we spend billions of pounds on foreign wars, which, by the way, don't have majority support. I mean, the majority of people in Britain want the troops home as fast as possible from Afghanistan. The majority of people opposed the bombing of Libya from the start in Britain. So, you know, it's completely undemocratic. It's being done against the wishes of the majority of the people, but we're told it has to happen. Now, these two things, it doesn't really add up. I don't believe that these wars do anything but actually generate misery in Libya and Afghanistan. And so they should stop spending the money on wars, and they should spend it on the things that people really need in a very desperate situation.
I lived in London for most of my life. I moved to Hastings about 18 months ago, just after I'd had him, just because it's a lot cheaper outside London than it is to live in London. So obviously I had to move because of the space, and I knew if I lived outside London I can get a bigger space for him and I can, for the amount of money I had at the time. So I had to make a tough decision to move out of London, really. Obviously for me, I know my situation because I have to find a job that revolves around my son, which is difficult. But if I was on my own, I would be working right now. Either starting at 6 in the morning, which I could not do, or they were starting where I'll be finishing at 12, 1 o'clock at night, which I could not do. It's not easy, to be honest, to find a job right now as a single mother.
There are two things that the government really needs to be looking at. That's the situation of families out of work and the situation of families in work. Currently, just over half of children living below the poverty line are in a household where there is at least one parent in work.
So low wages as well as worklessness is really quite a serious factor underlying our high levels of child poverty. We need a strategy that looks at the growth needed to create the jobs with the decent wages that parents want and that parents need. But we also need to be looking at the deficiencies in the welfare system that are actually going to be worsened by the action of this government with its programme of cuts that has been shown to hit the poorest much harder than the wealthiest. They did say in their austerity programme, everybody is in this together, but in practice that's not what we're seeing, so they do need to look again at these cuts.
The report of the IFS is actually shocking. It shows that far from the government meeting its promise to tackle child poverty, end child poverty by the year 2020, we're actually going to see a rise in child poverty, a massive rise in child poverty, more than 800,000 more children being in poverty in 2020 compared to this year. And that's simply unacceptable. It means that we're going to see, unless the government takes a drastic change of course, a whole generation of children's life chances lost to the consequences of poverty.
The current government is having to reduce the welfare bill as part of its deficit reduction package. Now, of course, it could have chosen to implement different measures involving less of an impact on the incomes of low-income households and more taxes on the median household, that's the person who's in the middle of the income distribution and against whose income the relative poverty line is set. And that would lead to a reduction in relative poverty. But it is even more difficult to see in such austere times that it would be politically achievable to get the level of increase in redistribution that would be required.
If we haven't got the money to run our health service properly or to build the houses that our people need, then why are we developing a new generation of nuclear missiles, the replacement of Trident, which is going to cost £76 billion? Why are we spending billions of pounds on keeping troops in Afghanistan, keeping troops on alert, and the RAF, the Royal Air Force, on alert over Libya?
Liam Fox's argument that the Libyan invasion or the Libyan operation was so expensive because it was high tech and not liable to kill civilians. I mean, you know, this is a joke on so many different levels, really, because first of all, we were told very early on that the Libyan operation would cost a few hundred million at most. That turns out to be not true. It's going to cost 1.7 billion or something of that order. Secondly, we're told, anyway, this is supposed to be an operation to save civilians. It's a humanitarian operation. And yet, even by Liam Fox's own admission, we clearly are going to be killing and have killed a whole number of civilians in Libya. For us to be spending this amount of money at a time when, as I say, we are also being told that it is essential that we have cutbacks in the public services, cutbacks in the NHS, cutbacks in the education system and so on, it's an outrage, really. No one wants these wars. You know, the justification for the wars don't add up anymore, which is why the opinion polls are so strongly against them. It's fundamentally a war about control of the region, about resource grabs, about Western powers and Britain, most importantly, trying to build their influence or maintain their influence in the Middle East. Why should British people be paying for this kind of corporate war at a time when we're also being told we have to make cutbacks in things that are really essential for us? It's a disgrace. The priorities of the government are all wrong, and we're going to carry on campaigning until they change.
The new government has come in. It has brought in this enormous austerity package, and the first thing it did was to take £40 billion per year away from the welfare budget. That affects families, that affects children, that affects the unemployed. And under the welfare reform bill that they're now trying to push through Parliament, from 2013 there will be a global limit on what a family can get in benefits of £500 per week. Now that sounds a lot of money. Sounds fantastic. But when the rent of a private house or flat in this area is £350 per week, only leaves £150 per week for everything else for a family with children. And that means that the levels of poverty are going to get worse, or poor working class families are going to be driven out of areas like this to live somewhere else. It's not a good situation at all, and I'm very, very angry about it. And I contrast this. I was angry with the Labour government for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the money that was spent on that. And I'm equally angry with this government for now proposing the replacement of the nuclear missile system by spending £76 billion on new nuclear missiles. This is ridiculous.
Evident from a child's point of view, but looking back and in hindsight, I can only imagine the struggle and the plight of someone like my mother, a single parent trying to raise four young people in the economic climate that we've seen in the last 10 years. It must have been an extreme struggle, but it's something that, you know, I look back with fond memories nonetheless, which is a testament of how well she's done.
There is a big gap between riches, people, and poor people in my area, and thinking all London and UK. And it's very hard to get job because the background, because the learning, the language sometimes, the hijab sometimes. So many challenges. So to improve your level of life, you need to work hard, double than any other person. So poor, they kept poor, maybe. Especially if they already are coming from different backgrounds and languages, and we don't have that chances like any other, like people learning or English their first languages.
I can imagine that life must have been very hard for parents like my mother to raise young people or young children in times where the food prices are the highest in Europe and travel is through the roof. Life must have been very hard, and obviously as a child that is kept away from you and you don't really understand. But I think that one thing that I can easily say, money wasn't a luxury for us and for me. And not to say that I feel in any way hindered by that, but I feel that was something that is definitely an issue and did prevent me from doing things that other young people were able to do.
In Britain, we measure both absolute poverty and relative poverty. The idea of absolute poverty is an income line that is held constant so that over time, if the national wealth is increasing, you should see the numbers of children in absolute poverty falling substantially. Relative poverty looks at the difference between the richest and the poorest. And that's really quite important because if you don't make progress on relative poverty, you end up with a situation of social segregation where the richest and the poorest are living quite separate, different lives from each other, and that can lead to all kinds of social problems in society.
It's really important that in terms of government policy, the government looks at its ambition to make work a route out of poverty. It's actually carrying out some radical reform of the welfare system in Britain. Wants to be able to guarantee that if people take jobs, they will be definitely better off than being on benefits, and that's a good thing. But unfortunately, the investment that's being put into the welfare system is not enough to guarantee that parents who are in work will be able to earn enough to raise a family. It's vital that the government supports more help for parents on their childcare costs, more help for parents who want to go back to work, more help for parents who want to work part-time, so that children are being able to be given the things they need by their parents who are in work.
I do think the government can do more to help single mothers, especially those who do want to go back to work and those who do want to better themselves. I think they should put more focus on that than looking for a job for the last 6 months at least. And I mean, as I said, I have got job offers, but the hours are not child friendly, and you know, so I can't accept those jobs. So that's why it has taken me a lot longer to find a job.
At the moment, we're in a situation where the big banks, which are essentially responsible for the economic mess that we're all in right now, are being bailed out by the government with taxpayers' money to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds, not just in Britain, but right across the world. And yet, we have a situation where, you know, these kids, these young people are suffering serious levels of poverty on a scale that hasn't really been the case for many, many years in Britain. And they're just allowed to, it's allowed to carry on. The scandal continues. And really what the government should be doing is changing its priorities drastically. The austerity policies that they're pursuing are making the economic crisis worse anyway, are leading potentially to a double-dip recession. What should be happening is the government should be responding to this crisis by actually giving money and resources to those who are suffering most from it, and that includes young people, it includes kids. So there needs to be a real shift in the priorities of the way the government is going.
We've been in an unwinnable war in Afghanistan, and we've spent £18 billion on it. We have a Trident missile system which costs £75 billion, which is a leftover from the Cold War, the Trident missile system, that's where it originated. So the weapon is aimed at absolutely nobody. Nobody seriously thinks there's going to be a nuclear exchange between superpowers now. Everybody knows that the Russian state is not going to launch a preemptive nuclear missile attack on London. So you have an entirely redundant nuclear weapon system costing billions of pounds, which is simply a virility symbol for the British government. So these are viewed, these weapon systems and the conflict are viewed in two totally polarised and opposed ways by the mass of the population in this country and by the government. And I believe it's only really a campaign of political disobedience and protest that will force the government to relinquish spending on these items. It has to become too painful politically to continue down this road before the government will give it up.
Obviously, people will be, you know, when they find out, people are very, very angry. I mean, we're talking around 1.7 billion for Libya. We're talking 4 to 4.5 billion a year on the occupation of Afghanistan and rising. We're talking about 70, 80, 90 billion pounds, depending on how you calculate it, on Trident. If you add all that together, you're talking about enough money to get rid of at least a third of the deficit that we're being told is the cause of austerity in the first place. So yeah, I think these figures are explosive figures. But I think people are angry anyway. I mean, the fact is, I think people are aware that wars cost a lot of money. And, you know, you look at all the opinion polls, they show that the majority of people want these wars to end and they don't want other wars to start. So, I mean, public opinion is actually on the side of the peacemakers. Public opinion is against the warmongers. And that's one of the things that is so outrageous about the situation at the moment, both in terms of the austerity measures and in terms of the wars they're fighting. The politicians in their Westminster bubble are way out of touch with the popular mood and popular opinion. And that's, again, one of the things that we have to overcome. We have to overcome this democratic deficit that is really plaguing this country badly now.
What about Bahrain and other places? Are we interfering there? Are we going there and supporting those people who are under, you know, military regimes and awful human rights? Look at our own human rights. We don't have a very good record of human rights. With all the sort of flights of rendition and people like Shaka Arma still sitting around. You know, where's Obama and Cameron in terms of stopping all this disgraceful stuff around the war? It's about time we pulled out of all these places and got our own house in order before we started interfering around the world, and bring our money back in-house as well. You know, because if we were to actually save the billions of pounds that's being spent at the moment on the wars around the world, and I think something like 40 billion quid or more, I'm not sure the exact figure right now, on Libya, on the interference in Libya. The Libyan people should have been left to deal with things themselves.
Weapons are always the last thing that go for a government. And war isn't... The logic, of course, is absolutely correct. In a period of austerity, you would think that the first thing that we could dispense with is foreign war. But viewed from the point of view of the government and the big corporations, actually that's precisely the point when you need to use your military might to sustain your economic position. We all know what's going on in Libya. The government is intervening militarily, and as soon as the military operation, well, before the military operation is even complete, British Petroleum and Anglo-Dutch Shell and other oil companies are busy renegotiating their contracts with Libyan oil so that their profits rise. So as far as the government is concerned, the war is a way of helping boost profits and get more money into the coffers in a sort of global strategic sense. Now, of course, to any ordinary citizen in this country, this is absolutely mad.
This government has come in and done the opposite. It's now said all the debts are going to be paid off in 3 years and that they will not continue the rising of benefits at the rate even of the retail price index, but only of the consumer price index, and that they will cut money on education, health, and local authorities who provide an awful lot of the primary services that many of the poorest people rely on. The cuts are hitting disproportionately at the poorest, disproportionately the most vulnerable, and making millionaires out of those people that pay very little in tax or go through a process of tax avoidance. What we're seeing is a growing gap between the richest and the poorest within our society. What we're seeing is growing poverty amongst the children in this country. It is unnecessary and it is wrong. The way out of a recession is to invest in the future. Invest in new houses, invest in new railways, invest in new infrastructure, invest in jobs for the future. We're already at between 8 and 10% national unemployment in this country. We're at 23% underemployment or not economically active in this country. And we have more than 20% of our young people without work, and it's going to get worse. This is not the way out. The way out is to invest in the future, not destroy the life chances of this generation.
The limelight. Kyle Rittenhouse, the 18-year-old teenager who shot and killed two men and wounded a third last year during protests of the police shooting of Jacob Blake, was found not guilty on Friday, 19th of November, of all charges by a Wisconsin jury. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Charles Blow. The piece is titled Rittenhouse and the Right's White Vigilante Heroes. Rittenhouse, the 18-year-old teenager who shot and killed two men and wounded a third last year during protests of the police shooting of Jacob Blake, was found not guilty on Friday, 19th of November, of all charges by a Wisconsin jury. One can argue about the particulars of that case, about the strength of the defense and the ham-handedness of the prosecution, about the outrageously unorthodox manner of the judge, and the infantilizing of the defendant. But Perhaps the most problematic aspect of this case was that it represented yet another data point in the long history of some parts of the right valorizing white vigilantes who use violence against people of color and their white allies. Kyle Rittenhouse has emerged as a hero and a cause celeb on the right, with people donating to help him make bail, and one Republican strategist telling the website Politico that he could see a future in which Rittenhouse became a featured speaker at the conservative conferences where activists congregate. The idea of taking the law into one's own hands, not only to protect order, but also to protect the order, is central to the maintenance of white power and its structure. The killers of Ahmaud Arbery, on trial in Georgia, are also vigilantes. George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed Trayvon Martin in 2012, was also a vigilante, and he was also embraced by the right. Money also poured in for George Zimmerman's defense. In 1984, subway vigilante Bernard Goetz shot four black teenagers who he said were trying to rob him. He was hailed as a hero, but then more details about him began to emerge. One of his neighbors wrote in New York Magazine that he had heard Goetz say at a community meeting that the only way we're going to clean up the street is to get rid of the spicks and niggers. This list is long and doesn't only include individuals, but also organizations and entire